A recent article in New Yorker magazine asked this question: do teens read seriously anymore? The article answers with a resounding no. We wonder, does anyone read seriously anymore? As followers of Jesus, we need to love the Lord with everything we are, including our minds. How important is reading for kids, parents, and youth workers? Does reading shape us? And what kinds of books should we be reading? We'll be talking with our friend Byron Borger about good reading habits and good books, along with much more on this edition of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Hey everybody, it's Walt Mueller at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, and welcome to this edition of Youth Culture Matters. I'm really excited to be here again with Jason Sochenik. Jason, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And we're going to talk today about all sorts of things related to youth culture. Before we came on, our producers, Chris and Kenton, were raising their hands as if they have some kind of question for us.
Oh, no.
And I think they're getting, I'm not sure if you guys are getting tired of our banter, which goes online and offline about the generational differences here.
No, you guys have great banter, but we just have a question to get you started, just kind of feel out what your differences are here. So just to get the conversation started, our question for you would be, name your favorite childhood sports hero.
Oh, man. Favorite childhood sports hero. Jason, you got somebody? I think I could guess who Jason's is. I
really?
Could guess
you
Jason's
probably can.
Is from.
Yeah, I bet you can.
All right,
actually, now that I think about this, probably can.
It's both.
And I bet
be...
I can also. I bet I could also name yours from the team. I don't know if the individual.
All right. Yeah, I was afraid you'd say something like Babe Ruth, and I'd have to deal with you then. But
No.
It's
I was
baseball,
more
right?
Joe
yours
DiMaggio.
Is, yours is yours is baseball, right?
It is baseball. Yes.
And it would be the Cubs.
It most definitely would be.
All right, I'll leave it at that. And I think the person you're going to name actually had a relationship with the team I'm going to name.
Yes.
Who
and
is
we
it?
Stole
Who is
him.
It? Yes.
Ryan Sandberg.
Okay,
yes,
Ryan Sandberg.
Yes, and we stole him from your team, the Phillies,
yeah.
Back in the early 80s. And we took him in his prime, and then we gave him back to you when
right.
he wasn't in his prime
right.
anymore.
Right, and it's the Phillies, not the Phillies. It's the
Phillies. The Phillies
yeah. And my favorite would be from the 1960s when I first started to love baseball and love the Phillies, who I've been rooting for my whole life. It took, well, I was going to say it took forever to get a championship, but
then you remembered I'm a Cubs fan?
Yeah, I remember you're a Cubs fan. But I would say my favorite was number six, the right fielder for the Phillies, Johnny Callison. And the amazing thing about it, he died a few years ago, but I got an autographed ball from him when I was a kid. And the other thing about him, here's a little trivia fact. He hit the winning home run, a walk-off home run in the 1964 All-Star Game at Shea Stadium to win it for the National League, Johnny Callison. So just
really? Was that when the All-Star Game really counted for something?
It did. Well, yeah. No, it didn't count for anything, but it was the league that chose the – it wasn't a vote.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, from the fans.
You know,
so, yeah, that would be
– I knew more about Ryan Sandberg in third grade than I probably did about anyone else. In fact, the amazing thing is I learned about Ryan Sandberg's high school, which now my kids will most likely go to, before I ever learned about the city that he lived in, which is Spokane, Washington.
Oh,
so I knew – about North Central High School, the school that he graduated from, before I ever knew about the city, about anything else. In fact, when I first moved to Spokane, Washington, you want to know the first place I visited? North Central High School.
No kidding.
Where he went to he was such a big hero in my life. I played second base when I was playing baseball. I posture batting. I remember practicing exactly how he would come to the plate. I mean, it wasn't anything special, but it was everything to me. He was what I wanted to be when I grew up.
And for me as a Phillies fan, one of the many bungled trades those guys made over the course of my life of rooting for those guys. So,
at least you have championships to
yeah, we do. We do.
Throw in my face.
Yes, we do.
We don't. Although I will say,
this is your year.
We're looking better. I don't say that. I'm a Cubs fan. I can't say this is our year, but I will say that this year looks quite promising.
Yeah, yeah. We're gonna have Steve Bartman on one of these podcasts, and we'll let you interview him. Hey,
that'll be good.
Let me just ask real quick, Chris, in a real quick, favorite childhood sports hero.
To stick with the baseball theme, contemporary of Sandberg, in fact, I would have to go with Don Mattingly.
Don Mattingly and
Mattingly.
He's a Yankees fan.
Yeah. Again, both of those have done better as players than they did as coaches.
It's all baseball so far. You're going to stick with baseball?
I'm not. I'm going to go away from baseball.
He's going to football.
I'm going to go to football, and I'm going to say Heinz Ward.
Okay. I thought you were going to go to, like, professional field hockey or something.
Heinz Ward.
Okay.
Really?
Heinz Ward.
He always has a smile on his face, even when something goes bad.
Okay. That's good, Steelers.
All right. He was even in the – he was in one of the Batman movies, so there you go. There's that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about youth culture, and let's talk about some of the trends. Yes. We do this little thing at the beginning called the two-minute drill, speaking of football and Heinz Ward. And so what we do is a little back and forth here. These guys will keep us on task with the bell when 2 minutes are up. But Jason and I have pulled together some of the most enlightening stories of the last few days, last few weeks, coming out of the world of youth culture. And, Jason, I'll begin. I got one that you may find interesting, but I thought this was interesting because it's about the most interesting man in the world. The Dos Equis guy has finally lost his job. Have you been tracking with this?
The most interesting
man in the world? Okay,
he
so
apparently is no longer the most interesting.
Yes, and I just think it was brilliant marketing. I always laughed. I was always waiting for what was going on. What's interesting, you know, what they would say about him. And I actually have a few of those. But here's what strikes me about this story. They send him off in true Dos Equis commercial fashion on a one-way trip to Mars. He said goodbye. You know, he's the most interesting man in the world, so he needs to go out in an interesting way. So he's on this one-way mission. And before he goes, they bid him farewell. They say his only regret is not knowing what regret feels like. I think those things are brilliant, you know, those
They're
descriptors.
Awesome.
But here's what's interesting about it is that it's about a shift in generations. Dos Equis is going to make a shift in their marketing and come up with another icon, another most interesting man in the world, I guess. It'll be interesting to see where they go to reach a new generation that they want to introduce to their beverages. So.
I think the thing that I find so interesting about it is that they're moving on because of age, because of the changing demographic, but they still want to have the most interesting man in the world or the most interesting person in the world. So we don't know where they're going, but the thing that I do find highly interesting is that the reason the most interesting man in the world was older was because of the knowledge. You can't have someone young be the most interesting person. They have to be older. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with their next talent.
And I'll just mention this, a trend. We need to watch this because I think we are putting a shelf life on human beings, putting a shelf life on knowledge, putting a shelf life on relevance as marketing takes over and nurtures and cultivates, especially the emerging generations. So we got to watch that. Favorite one. Once a rattlesnake bit him, after 5 days of excruciating pain, the snake finally died. I love that. Jason, what do you got?
We have to go the rest of the segment without using the word interesting.
Okay.
Oh, that would be hard. My favorite was he once had an awkward moment just to see how it feels.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's a good one.
those were always great. Well, the next one we have is adolescents drinking too much caffeine, and this may not be of any surprise to most individuals. I don't know about you, Walt, when your first caffeinated drink or something like coffee was ever digested. But for me, I actually didn't start drinking coffee until well into my 20s. It wasn't something that I looked forward to. But now I step into the classroom, I step into churches, and I see young teens holding Starbucks coffee, not Frappuccinos, nothing, but actual coffee, like just straight up coffee. And what they're finding is that that adolescents are one of the fastest growing populations of caffeine users, and that they're indicating that somewhere around 83% of teenagers consume some sort of a caffeinated beverage. And then at least 96% of them, almost all of them, have it occasionally. So this is something, a trend that is growing among adolescents, and one that is actually having a huge impact on then the way that they act, the way that they respond, the way that they hold themselves. I don't know if you've followed much of this, but it's what they're saying is that it's a culprit, but don't realize that some of the drinks that they're having include caffeine.
Right, and so, energy drinks as well, and they're taking powdered caffeine. We've done some of our one-minute radio spots on that. I think there's two things we need to be aware of here. One is that the health effects of this, and it's not good. You know, we need
jitterness,
to talk to
anxiety,
our kids about
sleep problems.
Right, we've got to talk to our kids about stewardship of their God-given bodies. We need to take care of the bodies. It's not good to introduce this stuff in high amounts at young ages, and even when you're older. But the other thing is, let's peel back the layers and say, why is this happening? And I think a lot of what's at the root of this is kids are trying to stay alert longer in an effort to deal with the stresses of life and all the busyness of life. You know, they're being pushed athletically. They're being pushed academically. They're being overscheduled. They're not taking Sabbath. They're not resting. And this just does not help. All right, let me move on. Here's a story that I don't know. If I say to you, Jason, who is the fifth Beatle? Or who was the fifth Beatle? Do you know who that would be? And there's controversy
on this. Yeah, I
actually would. Who
would
you
say? There is, and there's a couple of different people that you could mention, but I would actually bring up George Martin.
Okay, so
just as a longtime fan of the Beatles.
Yep.
Yeah.
So George
is that
Martin.
Who you were
going to
say?
George Martin. Yes, longtime producer of the Beatles, died a few weeks ago at the age of 90. And it was interesting to go back as a Beatles fan. You know, I was 7, 8 years old when the Beatles came to the U.S. I remember Beatlemania. I remember being swept up in Beatlemania, you know, at that young age. And when I say swept up, I'm not talking about the screaming and the yelling that you see in the audience on the Ed Sullivan show. I was certainly aware of that.
That was the image I had.
But, yeah, okay. But no, that wasn't me. But here's what's interesting. You know, all the trading cards, the cartoons that run on Saturday mornings, those were the ways that I was introduced to that, and certainly in record collections of friends, and even growing up. As I got older and was in middle school, I got swept up in that whole Sergeant Pepper's thing. And is Paul dead? Playing the record backwards, looking for all the clues on the album cover. You remember that multicolored album? And so I just went, and with George Martin's death, it made me a little bit nostalgic. But here's what struck me about his death that I think is something that's continued, and that is the way that music is marketed to us and even produced in ways to make it more marketable. Do you know what the Beatles' first, and again, there's some debate over this, do you know what their first number one hit was? Oh, there's silence there.
Was it Please Please Me?
Yes, that's it, Please Please Me, which there's some debate over actually what that song was about. But that first song, and by the way, the Beatles would say it's not about what people think about, you know, with the sexual innuendo and oral sex. But that particular song, when they first recorded it or brought it into the studio, it was at halftime. And George Martin said, if you double it up, you've got a hit. And he was right. And so we need to realize that music is, you know, engineered that way.
So I have to ask you this real quick, Walt, because you're such a big fan and you've known about the Beatles a lot longer than I have. Would you include George Martin as a more important Beatle than the other four that we're most familiar with, or as important?
Boy, that's a good question. I'd need to think about that. But you know, if he had as much of a role, if he played as much of a role in their production and their popularity as we're led to believe he did, then I'd say he probably was just as important.
Yeah, and I would agree.
What do you got?
Well, we're finding along going back to adolescence and caffeine, we're also finding results of sleep deprivation. And so Delaware is actually one of many states that has been having a lot of conversations about school start times, because what research is showing is that teens actually need 9 hours of sleep in order to be productive in a day's activities at school. And so there's more and more states, more and more school districts that are having the conversation around later start times, and that it's actually proven to be much more beneficial. It's much more sensible. It's actually cost effective. There's not much to it, and it doesn't actually affect extracurricular activity. And so schools like the one in Delaware is they're actually looking at starting at 9. I don't know what time you started school, but I remember our school started at 7 a.m. And I remember as a teen, and what statistics and science is actually showing now is most teens aren't going to bed until midnight or one anyways. So having this later start time would actually help with some of the sleep deprivation that is actually affecting study, is actually affecting the impact that's having in the classroom. So I think that the thing that I notice among teens is how tired they are, especially if I walk in on a first or second period. They're falling asleep as they're trying to engage material, but they're just really tired. Yeah. I don't know if this is something that you see when step into youth group.
We see it in our office here. Kenton, when he walked in today, his eyes were half closed, and he walked right into a wall. And we asked him what time he went to bed last night. He was in bed at 3 a.m.
Kenton would prefer that our start time here at CPYU were about 11 a.m., I think.
No, his start time ends in p.m., so we're working with him on that. But he's, as a college student, he's like that. Look, here's the thing with this, that number one, a lot of the research is saying schools should start later if kids are getting enough sleep, just because when they're most productive. But the other thing is all this texting while they're asleep, sleeping with their phones, that's not helping things. And parents need to monitor that. You're right. 9 hours, actually 9 hours and 15 minutes are needed for normal, healthy growth and development. All right. Now, here's a story that is, boy, this is going to be interesting to see how this unfolds, because this just came out and it's about the state of Michigan, their Department of Education. They have issued a directive here that is not highly publicized, but it is about letting students choose gender, choosing their names, and choosing which bathroom they use. They've drafted some guidance that would push the schools in the state of Michigan, this is the State Board of Education, to allow all students, regardless of parental or medical input, to choose their gender, their name, the pronouns that are used by teachers to refer to them, and the bathrooms that they use. The guidance states this, and I quote, "The responsibility for determining a student's gender identity rests with the student. Outside confirmation from medical or mental health professionals or documentation of legal changes is not needed." And they would say that gender identity is defined as a person's deeply held internal sense or psychological knowledge of their own gender, regardless of the biological sex they were assigned at birth. One interesting aspect of this that I find to be incredibly troubling is that a student could actually come to school and talk about what they want to be called, the pronouns they want to be used, what gender they are, and even the bathroom that they use. I mean, all those things, they can come to school and do all that. And the parents don't need to know. There's no need for the student or the school to inform the parents of what's happening. So I just throw this out there as informational. This is a trend that it's just happening so fast in our culture. We need
incredibly
to track
fast
with it.
Yeah. It's happening in our own state. We've had a lot of these conversations around bathroom use. But the one that you're talking about in Michigan is entirely different, because what it's doing is it's involving teens, young children, without the knowledge of the parent. And that is actually a very scary and it's a scary proposition that's being put forth. When we're not including parents inside the conversations such as these, it's actually really scary.
And we will address these things in coming podcasts as well.
We will. Well, one of the things that we had in recent news was Utah declaring pornography as a public health crisis. This is one of the first states that's actually said pornography is a public health crisis, and its Senate has voted to label pornography as such. In fact, it was voted 24-0 to approve a bill that labeled pornography as a public health crisis. And their reasons for it, which you and I are very aware of, was porn is shown to increase being used as sex education. It's lowering self-worth. It leads to unhealthy views of sex and relationships, increases the odds of infidelity, and is a major cause of divorce, among other problems. I just find this incredibly fascinating that we actually have an elected body that is actually now taking steps to say pornography is a public health issue. This is something you and I have talked often about. We speak to parents, we speak to teens, we speak to large audiences about the impact that pornography has. And so this is for me a step that I in the midst of everything else, and even in the midst of the last article we just spoke about, for me, this is a huge win. I think it provides opportunity for us to have more dialogue. And what I hope is that it provides opportunity to have more authentic and more vulnerable dialogue around the issues of pornography. Because when you have elected officials saying this, I actually think that it can actually change the conversation that is happening in the church, at the home, and in the schools. And I applaud Utah for doing this.
Right. We know it's addictive. We know the fallout is severe. There's lots of documented fallout. Horrible patterns relationally, health-wise,
yes,
spirituality. It just touches every area of life, and we know that it's not a good thing. Here's what's alarming about this, that it now takes a legislative body to govern something that we should be handling on our own, that we should be governing ourselves. All right, the last story I've got is this, and again, we keep coming back to this, and we're actually going to do a podcast on this at some point in the future here, and that is issues related to sports, youth football, concussions, CTE, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. We're hearing a lot about that in the news. There was a lawsuit that ended this last month that the plaintiff was a woman named Deborah Pike. She claimed that her son had suffered brain damage from repeated head injuries during his time in youth football, and it caused CTE. Of course, we can't diagnose that or understand that a person has that until after death. Autopsies show this. So the suit was settled with the Pop Warner Football League, and it was a $5 million case. The settlement was reportedly just under $2 million. Her son, Joseph, took his own life, sadly, in 2012 at the age of 25. He had played youth football for 4 years from the ages of 11 to 14, and her lawsuit claims that he suffered CT as a result. So, again, just an informational thing on a trend that we need to keep watching. And I think parents need to be diligent. Jason, you have young kids. And yes, it's important that we track with these things because, again, as a matter of stewardship of the body and good health, we need to be careful about what we let our kids play, where we let them play, at what age we let them play, and how often we let them play. So that's just a story on that that, again, we want to make people aware of. And youth workers, you need to be teaching on stewardship of the body and good health. Parents, you need to be monitoring this in your kids. So those are some news stories that we have to talk about today. We'll continue to track with things. What we're going to do when we come back from the break, Jason, is have a wonderful conversation with one of my dear friends that I have known for 38 years, have done ministry with for a long time, Byron Borger, who has one of the most unique ministries that I know of. He has a bookstore. And so I'm excited about introducing my friends to Byron, introducing you to Byron, Jason, and having a great conversation about reading, the importance of reading. Reading is a spiritual discipline. And then we're going to talk about some great books that we all need to be aware of. So stay with us, and we'll be right back after this break. Youth workers, here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, we want to help you help parents stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of our most popular resources is our monthly parent page. This four-page, full-color resource offers parents a timely, practical look into current youth culture trends, along with resources to help them parent their children and teens Christianly in today's rapidly changing youth culture. If you're a youth worker who would like to get this monthly resource into the hands of your parents, you can see a sample parent page and learn more by visiting cpyuparentpage.com. Welcome back, everybody. This is Youth Culture Matters, and Jason, I am really excited about what we're going to talk about today because this is foundational to everything in life, I think, learning, and we learn a lot by reading, and I'm always excited about passing on the titles of good books that I've read and books that I need to read to parents, to youth workers, to others, and I can't think of a better person to have here to talk about reading than my friend Byron Borger from Hearts and Minds Bookstore. Byron and I go back 38 years, Byron, I think, 1978.
Probably, yeah.
When I came to work for the Coalition for Christian Outreach, I was young, fresh out of college. How old were you in 1978?
I don't know. I was like 23, maybe.
23. You were old. You were 2 years older than me. So
yeah, a little older.
I came in with all these men. And, you know, now I look, I'm going, they're all my age. But Byron, where were you working at that point in time, doing campus ministry?
I was doing campus ministry with the CCO at a branch campus of Penn State in McKeesport, which is out near Pittsburgh.
And the CCO, for those who are not familiar with it, is the Coalition for Christian Outreach, a wonderful campus ministry group that in many ways not only provided me with great training and was formative, but instilled in me a deeper love for reading. So that's what we want to talk about today is reading. And so, Byron, you made a very interesting transition from campus ministry to what you're doing now. Tell us about that, what you're doing now.
Well, the transition itself is interesting because, as you say, we did work for the CCO, and we would do campus ministry with students, reading books together about their vocation, their calling. I didn't know what it meant to be a Christian in nursing or engineering, so I would invite college students to say, let's read books together. And they would always say to me, you ought to have a bookstore. You ought to have a bookstore because you're always making us read these books, theology and the different academic disciplines and the mind of Christ in different areas of life. So these students would tease me. Well, when we left CCO, we had a baby, wanted to move home. We didn't know what to do. And so we said, let's open a bookstore. So we opened a bookstore 34 years ago almost. Independent store in a small town, wondering if this wide-as-life Christian worldview stuff that we were learning from the CCO with college students could translate into an ordinary small town for ordinary folks and ordinary churches. So our bookstore is laid out like any other bookstore would be, with categories like film studies and urban architecture and history and politics and science and business and law and engineering and environmental studies. And so sometimes people walk in and they look and they see film studies or, you know, science. And they say, oh, we're looking for the Christian bookstore in town.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of Christian bookstore is this?
Yeah, huh? What kind of Christian bookstore? You don't know whether to laugh or cry. You know, oh, we have books on art, so that means we're not a Christian bookstore. But seriously, we've had people tell us there just are not faith-based bookstores that are arranged with all different categories of life, from novels to the arts to politics to science. And so publishers kind of take notice of us pretty early on. To try to help us figure out how to pioneer what a bookstore ought to look like from a Christian perspective.
Yeah. And so, you know, I go back and I think about our years with the CCO, the Coalition for Christian Outreach, and the types of things that we were talking about with students. I was like you. You know, I was a sociology major in college at a Christian college, so I learned about the intersection of faith and sociology. But what about those other areas? Now, and that, when you were talking about that, that's what I think youth workers and parents, we need to hear about that because, by and large, when it comes to faith, as Christian youth workers, Christian parents, followers of Jesus, we think, well, let's get our kids to be Christians. Let's get them, quote unquote, saved. And
sure.
We think that's the end of it.
Yeah.
And the reality is,
that's just the beginning.
It is. It is. And there's so much to life and, you know, to discover interests and bents, gifts and abilities that our kids have. And then feed them a knowledge of what it means to integrate their faith into what they're going to do for the rest of their lives and really make a difference. You know, if we like to use the word flourish.
Yeah.
You know, to really flourish as human beings is a great thing. And that's what I love about the store. Now, the store's name is?
Hearts and Minds.
And explain that title.
Well, there's a verse in Jeremiah that says, the hearts and minds of the people are exceedingly wicked. But that wasn't our main verse. There's the verse in Philippians, you know, the peace of Christ will dwell in your hearts and minds. So, you know, there's biblical warrant for that phrase. But for us, again, the Christian faith is both about knowing stuff, about learning, being a disciple, is to be a lifelong learner. So being a learner and mastering content that we do need to know includes the life of the mind.
Yeah.
But it also is more than just the mind, particularly as Jamie Smith has been telling us lately, that the deepest things in life are not just cognitive, but they're deeper than that. They're pre-theoretical. They're the things of the heart. And so the deepest things out of the heart flow the issues of life, the Proverbs say.
Yeah.
So we got to get at both that balanced understanding of learning content using our mind and developing the mind of Christ, but also allowing that to shape the deepest things of our lives, the heart and the habits and the virtues and the character. I think when we're working in youth ministry or adult ministry, shaping hearts and minds is so very important.
So for a youth worker, then, when we think about spiritual disciplines, you know, I want my kids to pray. I want my kids to be involved in missions. We would add to that, we want our kids to read.
Oh, absolutely. And through church history, the great monks and stuff, Richard Foster in that famous book, Celebration of Discipline, lists right up there with prayer and fasting and meditation and worship and scripture study, the studying of good books. Study has always been considered in church history a spiritual discipline.
Yeah.
And in our fast-paced, hot-wired world, we tend to lose that. We have an anti-intellectualism, particularly in American culture. And so we tend to not think of reading and studying as spiritual. But, you know, the Bible says to love God with all your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I think reading is actually an act of worship, amongst other things.
Right.
Learning and growing and discipleship and mission. We read to understand the culture, as you help us understand so well. So reading is a whole variety of things. But one of the basic things it is, it's an act of worship.
Yeah. And you know, I love to read. And, you know, I'm old enough now, 59, to be able to look back and say, books, good books, have really formed me. I think probably more than anything else, that's how I've learned, and so I really get excited about telling youth workers and parents about good books, because it's good for them, but trying to get kids to read as well. Now, one of the challenges is that in today's world, today's society, and Jason and I, we talk back and forth about this from time to time, is technology and how that's changed our reading. So, for example, we've talked in the past about kids are reading more words in terms of volume, but they're disjointed words. They're words on the screen. They're little bits and pieces from here, there, and everywhere. And consequently, they're not reading books from start to finish. There's a little video clip we use from here at CPYU from a Frontline episode where it starts with an honors student at a very highly esteemed high school in New Jersey who he basically narrates and says to the camera, I never read a book.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't read
right.
a book for,
right.
you know, years. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, what do we do about that? And how do we get kids to read? So I think youth workers and parents are uniquely positioned to get kids reading and get them to read from start to finish. Talk a little bit about paper. We both listened to a podcast yesterday from NPR on reading. And the good news is that the paper book is flourishing. It's doing well.
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. So from the standpoint
It's not
of,
over yet.
Okay. Right.
I'm
right.
a little pessimistic, but, you know, the culture just is aimed against us because, as Neil Postman once put it, we are amusing ourselves to death.
Right.
So we want entertainment. We went fast. We went quick. A friend of mine has a book coming out this summer. It's called Reading for the Common Good, a guy named Chris Smith. And it's brilliant. It's just brilliant. But he was going to call it slow reading to kind of get at like slow food as opposed to fast food, the slow food movement. He said, what would it look like to do church in a slow way? So he wrote a book called Slow Church. But this sort of slower paced, attentive, divine sort of reading where we're viewing it as a spiritual discipline is not the way people tend to think. So we've got this countercultural value and this uphill battle to get people to slow down and want to read books.
Yeah.
So it's I'm a little pessimistic, but God can do great things. The books have been used all throughout the history of redemption. My concern about technology, God made technology as a good thing, so it's a gift from the Creator.
Right.
But there is a downside to it. And, you know, even guys like the Shallows, like Nicholas Carr,
yep.
talked about the F scan, where
yes.
online, on screens, we train ourselves to read left to right a couple of lines. Then we scan down the left and read maybe half a line. And then the end of the page, we're just scanning the left column. And they've hooked up electrodes and stuff to people's eyeballs so they can literally prove this, that when you watch things, when you read online, on screens, you scan with this. Then you pick up a regular book after learning the habits of having done that.
Read it the same way.
And you read it the same way.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary when you think that your surgeon, who's been reading blogs and learned this habit of the F-stop, now all of a sudden picks up his surgery textbook and has... And just intuitively skims it.
Okay,
because
now you're scaring me.
Yeah, it is scary. We have adopted.
I hadn't thought of that.
We've adopted new patterns of how we even read real books. So I'm not. I blog. I'm online all the time. But I think we just have to train ourselves to be attentive to these blocks of paper and ink and these gifts of authors that are called books, having them around, passing them around, having kids see that we read them. I think kids want to read books. I have young people tell me all the time that they don't like e-books. Maybe their baby boomer parents or their, you know, older, their grandparents gave them a Nook or something for Christmas. And I have, you know, 18-year-olds telling me, I don't like it.
Right.
I know
right.
kids have tattoos, you know, of books that they've read. You know, kids love books. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
But it's countercultural to take that stand and learn to read them well.
Yeah.
Byron, I'm...
Go ahead, Jason.
Well, no. I find this really fascinating because I'm actually just really curious because your store is so unique as a Christian owning a bookstore and the way in which it's done. Here on the West Coast, it's actually such a unique proposition and one that I really love. I'm actually really curious, though, from the time that you started to now, what your typical customer looks like. When they come in the door, do they look any different? Not in the way they dress, obviously, but more in the way that they're looking for books, more in the way that they're buying their books. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any difference in the way in which the readers that are coming through your door are looking for and then buying?
That's a tremendous question.
What he's asking, by the way, Byron, is there an increase or a decrease in the people coming in looking for Amish fiction?
Yeah, the Amish fiction around here is a big deal, all over. Well, you know, we're in a small town. And it's a fairly conservative central Pennsylvania region. So it may not be the bellwether place to look to get national trends. But I think in our own community, what we've seen is a mix, both in the 80s and the 90s and now, of folks that this is a new idea, that you can read for the kingdom, that reading matters to God, that we can carry so-called secular books, that we should read novels, even Pulitzer Prize-winning secular novels can be helpful in our spiritual lives. So people are both blown away by that and sometimes offended even. We've lost customers because we carry Harry Potter or something. On the other hand, there's people that get it. Back in the 80s, there were people reading Francis Schaeffer or what have you. Now they're, you know, going to Q conferences and they walk in our store and they're like, holy smokes, this is fantastic. This is what I've been looking for. So the sort of demographics of our customers have been then and now, both people that have no clue what we're doing and they're sort of perplexed. Why would you have books about architecture in a Christian bookstore? Or why so much stuff on creation care or international peacemaking or what have you, racial reconciliation? Like, why do you go with all these things? Some people don't get it. And other people immediately or intuitively about that. I think more people are embracing that now than perhaps they did in the 80s. We had to explain ourselves more then, where now younger adults have sort of rejected a dualism of sacred and secular. They've read Walt's books. They understand we can engage culture. There isn't quite as much fear as there was in the 80s amongst evangelicals. So my sense is that more people sort of get it now. However, they also are buying e-books. They're going to Amazon. So they come in our store. They look around. They love what we're doing. And then they go to the porno dealers at Amazon to buy the books.
Yeah.
So that's the big difference is people are excited about what we do now, but they don't support us like they used to.
Yeah. You and by one of the things, you know, that's really interesting, and Jason, this is why I can't wait for you to come out and take you down there, is that, and I'll just see, Byron, I hope you don't take offense at this, but when I think of you, I think of you more as an educator than as a business person. I know that that's a compliment to you, I think, and that's clear, and probably your, well, for example, you know, anybody, we've had people call here and say, you know, I'm looking for a book on, and typically I can't answer their questions. And I'll say, you need to email Byron Borger. And then I just go, okay, Byron's going to be staying up till 3 or 4 a.m. now because I know how seriously he takes that. And rather than just sending an email back saying, oh, by the way, here's two titles, it's, you know, 10 titles
and described.
and when you look at when these things are sent, you know, it's 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and I'm wondering if this guy ever sleeps.
Don't tell my secrets.
But here's the thing. Here's a beautiful thing, and this is, you know, something we want people to plug into. Tell us about your book notes, your book notes blog, because I find that to be absolutely incredible and fascinating.
Well, Walt, your support means a lot to me, and so thanks for saying this. But our book notes blog is just a book review blog that I do every couple of days. It'll do lists of books, my favorite books on prayer, or I'll do 10 new books that have just come out that week, giving you a description. Or sometimes I dig in and do, you know, two or three books that I'll go on for pages and pages about. I've done two really long blogs on Jamie Smith's new book, You Are What You Love. We were the first place to write about it, I think, at least seriously write about it. But it's such an important book. I just went on pages and pages. I've been kidded already that sometimes I write more about a book than pages in the book.
I think I've said that to you.
Every now and then I get carried away. But yeah, Book Notes is a book review blog. People can subscribe to it. We offer discounts on the books I write about. And that's the main thing we do to get the word out in our cyber community. About a third of our business is online stuff and mail order.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, I mean, and we're going to talk about this later, but give us the web address so people can go there and subscribe.
Well, it's www.heartsandmindsbooks.com. Okay. Hearts and Minds Books, all spelled out, one long word, heartsandmindsbooks.com. We send books all over the world, actually. It's been kind of fun.
Now, and here's something else you haven't mentioned, but I'm going to mention this, and this is what I find fascinating, and that is that because of the approach you take to books and the way you run your store and the bent of your store, you actually have publishers and authors consulting with you to ask questions about writing books and things, you know.
Occasionally.
Well, I know that happens a lot more than you're going to tell us, but I find that absolutely fascinating and a wonderful thing. And by the way, Byron also does the most amazing book tables at events that you'll ever see. It's just phenomenal. How many books did you take to Jubilee this year?
I don't even know how many books. It took us 2 days to set them all up.
Okay.
28 tables, two shelves on, you know, two layers of each. So it took days and days and days.
It's unbelievable.
We probably took more books to that conference than some bookstores have in their entire store.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of books. We're fortunate to be able to to invest everything we got into new books. And we'd go out and do book displays. That's about a third of our business, too, traveling around the conferences.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question before we take a break. Jason is really embedded in the college culture on the West Coast, Christian College. And
Whitworth, Spokane.
Yeah, at Whitworth. In fact, Hearts and Minds is a part of our philosophy. So
yeah,
it fits
Whitworth.
Right in line with it.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So, and you've become a superstar at the Jubilee Conference, which is a gathering of, 3,000 to 4,000 college students every year annually in February
in Pittsburgh.
To talk about matters of faith and life, integrating faith and life, run by the Coalition for Christian Outreach. In just tell us in a minute, how do we get college students to read? Because the students there are reading.
Well, I think you model it, for instance. I mean, mentors and youth workers and youth pastors have to just show that books have transformed their lives. You let the content lead, that these are good and beautiful works of art. Books have to be well written, and their life-giving information can be transformational. So you share how this author or this book or this line transformed my life, and then you pass that on to others. So it's just like we get people enthused about anything else. You just give them a taste of it. You let them see how it works. You put the books into their hands. You work with them. You read together in community.
Yeah, that's great. Now, when we come back from a break, this is where we're going to have some fun, because I've asked Byron to bring some books that we need to read, youth workers, parents, everybody for that matter. So we're going to talk through. We're going to hear him in rapid fire talk about some exciting books. And
don't try this at home, folks. We're going to go fast.
Yeah, it'll be fun. So stay with us. And when we come back from a break, we're going to talk about specific books. Our mission here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding is to put you in touch with the latest information and analysis on today's youth culture. If you're a parent, youth worker, pastor, educator, grandparent, or anyone else who loves kids, we want to invite you to receive our free weekly Youth Culture e-update. You can receive the Youth Culture e-update in your email by going to our homepage at cpyu.org, scrolling to the bottom of the page, and following the simple instructions where it says e-update sign up. Get signed up so that you can stay in touch with the latest in today's youth culture. Well, welcome back. I'm Walt Mueller with the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, and Jason Sochenek and I are here today with Byron Borger talking about books. Byron runs Hearts and Minds, which is a very unique bookstore in Dallastown, Pennsylvania, near us. We love Byron. We love what he says about books. Byron, we're gonna ask you about some books here specifically, which is going to be fun. But before we do that, we've got this little thing we do called Take Five, and you have no idea what I'm going to ask you here. I'm going to ask you five questions in rapid-fire succession, and you've got to give me your answer. So there's
if
nothing.
If people were here in the studio, they would see a very devious look on your face,
which
is a little scary.
This is good. I'm actually going to set you up with one. I'm going to see if you know where I'm going with it. But
All right.
So you ready? Here we go. This is just to get to know you a little better. So first question, when you were 10 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A professional football player.
Okay. All right. I was afraid it was going to be bookseller.
No.
Number two, if you could have dinner with anyone, living or dead, who would it be?
My wife.
I get that.
That's a great
answer. Nice. Wow.
Yeah.
If Beth is listening, that's
an
wonderful.
Response.
Besides your wife, let me change the question. Besides your wife, if you could have dinner with anyone living or dead, who would it be?
Living or dead?
Yeah.
Not Jesus, of course. That's
right.
Sort of cheating.
Yeah, that's right. That's
anybody.
Man. Yeah. You've got so many books on your shelf. There's got to be somebody whose name is under a title that you'd go, I would love to be able to chat with that guy.
Well,
I think I know who you might say, but I'm not going to answer for you.
One of my absolute favorite pop singers is a guy named Jackson Brown.
Okay, yeah.
And I had a 20-second meeting with him once.
Okay.
And I think I would love to continue that conversation.
Okay, all right, good. All right, so maybe you just answered question number three, favorite musical artist of all time.
Oh, I can't say all time, but it would be a toss-up between Bruce Coburn from Canada,
yep.
Jackson Brown,
yep.
Bill Mallaney from the Vigilantes of Love.
Oh, yeah, great songwriter. Yeah. Great songwriter.
Maybe Van Morrison.
Love.
Van Morrison, another good one.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
all right.
I love the new Indigo Girls album.
Okay. All right. That's enough.
I'm dating myself.
Number four.
You too. You got to say you too.
I know.
I'm really dating myself now.
Okay.
The head and the heart.
All right. Here we go. Book question. Outside of the Bible, what one book would you put in the hands of a new follower of Jesus today? What one book would you put in their hands?
Well, see, I reject the question because there's no one book for everybody.
Wait a minute.
Depend who they are. Depend who they are, how old they are, what they're like, if they're interesting. That's huge. There is a book called by Jefferson Bethke.
Right.
Called Jefferson Bethke.
It's Not What You Think.
Okay, all right.
I'm real taken with that book.
All right, good,
days.
Good. That's
nice.
A good answer. Number five. By the way, just remind me from now on, people are not allowed to reject the questions. We have to go over the rules ahead of time. All right, number five. The most interesting college roommate you ever had. I'm setting you up with this. Come on.
My most interesting? Well, a housemate in my house was a guy named Bill Romanowski.
That's okay. I knew you lived with
him. Eyes Wide Open, a book on pop culture.
Yeah, I was
and we used
up
to argue
that.
About music and film, and he's now a famous writer and teacher at Calvin College, Bill Romanowski.
We love his book.
Yeah.
We love his book. Yeah, Eyes Wide Open. Okay, good. All right, so that's a good transition into books now. You did well there, except for your protest.
Yeah.
Let's talk about books. What did you bring? And you know, youth workers, parents, anybody. And I know these. And when I asked Byron to bring the books, I said, I don't necessarily want youth ministry books or parenting books because we have to read widely.
Yeah, we have to read widely. I'll tell you what. We should read novels. We should read poetry. You know, Wendell Berry has a new book of poetry coming out there. Somebody I'd like to sit down and eat with. One way into this conversation about reading, there's a guy named Douglas Wilson who wrote a book recently called Writers to Read. The subtitle is 9 Names That Belong on Your Bookshelf. And he sort of dissects and explains Chesterton and P.G. Wodehouse, the British comedian, T.S. Eliot, Tolkien, Lewis, Robert Capon, who is an Episcopal priest that writes books about food that are just glorious, Marilynne Robinson, a contemporary novelist and Calvin scholar. So he writes about 9 different people. And it just gives you sort of a way to appreciate some of the best writers of our time. So that little book, Writers to Read, is really nice. A book that arrived just yesterday, I haven't read it yet, but it just came, is by Lucy Shaw, one of my favorite poets. It's a long-awaited book called Thumbprints in the Clay. You know, you put your thumbprint in a piece of pottery to kind of show, well, that's what God has done over the whole creation. You know, we live in this wonderful world of wonder, and Lucy helps us sort of appreciate beauty. N.T. Wright, in a book called Surprised by Hope, said beauty is like a breadcrumbs. You know, you follow the track back home to see the glory of the way the world is supposed to be in the world we were made for. So beauty becomes sort of an avenue. And so reading beautiful writing in itself is a real benefit.
And let me say something about that. That sounds like, and that's brand new.
Yeah, just
InterVarsity Press. The beauty of that is that we just are so into being tethered to our technology.
Yeah.
We don't slow down. We miss the beauty.
Yeah.
So does she.
And that's what poetry helps us do.
Yeah.
It helps us slow down. Good writing can help us attend to things. So, yeah, I think reading good writers just for the beauty of their words. The book that won the Pulitzer Prize this past year for fiction is called All the Light We Cannot See. It traces two teenagers in pre-war Germany.
Yep.
The sentences are so absolutely beautiful. It's a big, thick book, and I just didn't want it to end.
Yeah.
An experience of the arts in a certain sense, of the literature and beauty of writing. I think that can be transforming in many, many ways. I think Marilynne Robinson's novels. I think Wendell Berry's novels. So immersing ourselves in good writing, Eugene Peterson, in poets and in writers is important. But I mentioned earlier that my friend Chris Smith has a book coming out this summer. We're taking pre-orders for it called Reading for the Common Good. And it's a significant, slow study of why reading is important to the kingdom of God.
Good.
So that's some books just about reading and the life of the mind.
By the way, that one you mentioned, the what'd you say?
All the Light You Cannot See.
Lisa read that. My wife Lisa read that. Loved it. Couldn't put it down.
Oh, what a book.
So,
really
great
makes
book.
You think.
That's on my list. I got to read that.
Little rough language at a couple of points, but it's beautiful stuff and important stuff. Just a couple for youth workers. We know a lot of your listeners are youth workers. There's a recent book called Gospel-Centered Youth Ministry. One of the students you've impacted in your
Mike
work.
Mike McGarry.
Walt is in here.
Mike
an old friend of mine is in here, Darren DePaul. It's edited by Cameron Cole and John Nielsen, and it's just a study of what it means to keep the gospel absolutely central in youth work. From beginning to end, all that we do, from discipleship to games to retreats, keeping the gospel of Jesus Christ and grace at the heart of it all, looks really, really nice.
And this grows out of the Rooted movement, by the way, which is a new youth ministry movement.
Oh, yeah.
Aligned with a gospel coalition,
with gospel
gospel-centered
coalition.
Youth ministry.
Yep.
So, good.
When you hear that phrase, gospel-centered, I mean, who doesn't want to be gospel-centered?
Right.
But they mean a certain particular thing by that. But this is just whether it's playing dodgeball or whether it's going on retreats. The gospel of grace has got to be central to
and
that.
And we've lost that in youth ministry. So for the youth workers who are listening, this is, I think, in many ways a corrective. And I like the word centered because it gets us centered back on where we need to be.
Now, for youth workers that want to kind of really beef up their game and get a textbook that's going to cover everything from a whole variety of perspectives, there's a new book called Adoptive Youth Ministry, Integrating Emergent Generations into the Family of Faith. This idea of adoptive youth ministry is edited by Chap Clark. Walt, you're in here, so why don't you tell people what this book's about?
Basically, it's a paradigm for youth ministry that with Chap's sense over the years with Hurt and Hurt 2.0 of systemic abandonment being the defining characteristic of the emerging generations. What does it mean now to adopt kids into the church?
Into
the family of God and in the family of faith. And then realize their status as adopted sons and daughters of Jesus Christ. So it's written as a textbook.
It's a great tool.
But I think it's a good one, you know, with all the people who have contributed.
There's like 25 chapters on all kind of things, practices and skills and the call of youth workers to do this stuff, both the theology of being adopted in Christ to be sons and daughters, but also what it means to adopt people or enmesh people into the family of faith. Your chapter in here on culture and what we mean by culture is probably adapted from other works of yours. If you want, somebody wants a summary of what Walt
Basic
is about
overview,
here, it is really, really good. The first chapter I read when this came, there's a thing about thinking theologically in here about adoptive practices. So that's a really, really good book. And Walt,
and
you're
practically
just doing...
speaking,
yep.
And practically speaking, that has been a phenomenal book for a lot of the youth ministry students at Whitworth.
And so they're using it this semester
recently,
out there.
Yeah, well, and they just recently had Chap come out and speak, and it was a powerful experience for them, and it's a great tool that they're really excited to pour into. So I would highly suggest that book. It's a great resource.
Chap and Walt are just doing the most cutting edge, significant stuff for the body of Christ. Whether you're in a mainline denominational church or an independent church, reformed or not, doesn't matter. Read their stuff, and this is a great way to dip into a lot of their stuff.
And I'm going to mention this, but just you know, Marv Penner, Duffy Robbins.
Everybody's
there. They've written, you know, they're on associate staff with us, so they've written for this as well. So we're pretty excited about this. I think this is a good contribution to the world of youth ministry.
Well, here's something that's a contribution to the world of youth ministry, and this is going to rock people's world if they don't know about it. Do you think many of your listeners know Andrew Root's book called Bonhoeffer as Youth Worker?
I think many of them would know Andy's name. I'm not sure they know about that
and
book.
And they've heard of Bonhoeffer.
Yeah.
Everybody knows Life Together.
Right.
Cost of Discipleship's a little harder. Everybody's read Eric Metaxas' magisterial, wonderful book on Bonhoeffer. And Charles Marsh's more recent one as well. So everybody knows Bonhoeffer. Few people know that he spent time in youth ministry and that he wrote about youth when he was starting this underground seminary for which he died. So this is the theological vision of both radical discipleship, as in cost of discipleship, and community, adopting people into life together, his two most seminal books, and how that relates to youth ministry. Agree or not with Andrew Root completely, he teaches up at a Lutheran seminary up in the Pacific Northwest, or in the Minnesota area. Yeah. But this is a remarkably provocative book and should be on everybody's reading list. Bonhoeffer as Youth Worker by Andrew Root. Mm. Now, a book that isn't about youth ministry, but is about teens and parenting teens,
right,
is a brand new book by our friend Dan Dupuy, who just recently was the CEO of the Coalition for Christian Outreach out in Pittsburgh. Dan, with his connection in campus ministry, gathered together teenagers in college, old teens and early 20s. So they were college-age kids, and basically got them talking about their parents. And then he connected with parents talking to them in focus groups about their kids. And it's sort of informal research. Research may be overstating it a little, but collected a lot of data and did a lot of good listening to both kids and their parents. And everybody was agreeing that parents, or the teens were agreeing, that parents have more impact over the life of young adults than they realize. There is this mythology in the culture and even in the church that, okay, when kids go off to college, when they leave the home to trade school or whatever, our work as parents is sort
right,
of done.
Right, influence stops, yeah.
And he says, no, it is not too late. We play as parents an essential part in the role of young adult children, young adult youth. So this is a parenting book, although youth workers should know about it, because it's really the only book I know of about parenting older teens to prepare them for that transition into college or trade school or going into the professional
world. And while they're there. Yeah. And while they're there.
It is a parenting book, but it's a parenting book with this sense of working with older teens and the influence parents can have, including stuff like developing the life of the mind. Hearts and Minds is mentioned in it for what it's worth. The Jubilee Conference is mentioned for what it's worth. Helping kids develop a sense of vocation and calling about what they should do with their lives. That's a deeply theological question, the doctrine of vocation. But we concede that to guidance counselors at school who tell you the demographics of where jobs are going to be as if it's primarily a financial question, instead of saying, what does God want you to do with your life? So even helping parents navigate that question of vocation and calling with their young adult children. Great book.
We've identified that issue of vocation and calling as a main issue that youth workers need to address that we're not addressing. And because the culture is writing the script and a narrative for work, and that's how we see it, is work to make money, to accumulate goods and somehow find redemption there, and it's just a dead end. So that's great.
Well, I don't know if it's right for me to toot my own horn, but one of the things that I put together was a book called Serious Dreams. Now, this is for people graduating from college, although some people have given it to high school kids.
Yeah.
It was designed for college grads. There's all kind of little books you can give to teenagers. A lot of them are kind of cheesy, but a lot of little graduation books. This is a graduation gift for college graduates. And what I did is I went around and found college commencement addresses by Nicholas Waltersdorf and John Perkins and Steve Garber and Richard Mao and Amy Sherman that wrote Kingdom Calling and myself at Geneva.
Right.
And those of us that did these kind of rousing speeches about making a difference in the world, taking up your vocation and calling to make a difference as salt and light in the workaday world. This vision of vocation. One person said it's like the Jubilee Conference in their pocket. So it's a handful of addresses, conversation questions and reflection questions at the end of each one, helping young adults make the transition from college into the real world, so to speak. There's no book like it in print. And these speeches, quite apart from my own, these are great folks like Nicholas Waltersdorf and John Perkins and Amy Sherman offering great, great inspirational talks for young adults.
Oh, this is great. And I'm going to borrow this because I have to give one of those in a month.
It's a nice little book. Published here in Lancaster by Square
right
Halo Books.
There,
Square Halo Books is a great little publisher right here in Lancaster.
Yeah.
My book of the season, it may be my book of the year, Walt, is You Are What You Love by Jamie Smith. The subtitle is The Spiritual Power of Habit. You could do a whole podcast just on this.
And I think we will.
Smith, of course, is a philosopher who's written some very heavy books, including Imagining the Kingdom and Desiring the Kingdom. And this, in a certain sense, is a summary of those two books and what will be the third one in that trilogy called Embodying the Kingdom. What Smith believes is that we are not merely, as he puts it, a brain on a stick. And so transformation doesn't just happen from opening up the old noggin and dumping in content. If that were true, we would all be transformed because we have so darn much content and good books and good lessons and good podcasts. But these things, frankly, don't change people's lives. He suggests what transforms lives from the inside out is the transformation of our desires, what we really want. St. Augustine said, if you want to know what somebody's life, don't ask them what they believe, but ask what they love.
Yeah.
So transforming That's our great. Loves happens through liturgy. So this is essentially a book about worship and about being transformed in the life of the church for the sake of the world. He's not a dualist that wants to run from the world, but he says if we're going to equip people to engage the culture as well they should, they've got to become a different caliber of person. And that happens as our character is transformed by new virtues, new desires, new wants. We re-index or recalibrate our heart to want the right things in the right way. So how does that happen?
Yeah.
You are what you love, the spiritual power.
Yeah, can I just ask? Okay, so that's a book, and I've read what you've written on that.
And it's not hard.
I still have to read it. But I look at that book, and I'm going, okay, we got to get that in the hands of youth workers. How
Absolutely.
Would that transform youth ministry?
Well, he has a whole section on home life, on parenting kids, on the relationship of church and home, because it doesn't only happen in church. It happens in home. But it is very much about giving kids a desire for the kingdom of God, recalibrating their tastes and their wants. And that means a counter-narrative to what the world is getting you. Because the book starts out saying the thickest liturgies in our culture are the secular ones, going to the mall, putting our hand over our heart when we go to a ball game and sing the national anthem. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but the liturgies, the habit-forming rituals that we do in the secular world shape us more than we know.
Yeah.
And having a so-called Christian worldview, right ideas about the goodness of the creation or the lordship of Christ, isn't thick enough to undo those liturgical subconscious things that are calibrating our desires and our wants.
Yeah.
So to get at understanding the goal of discipleship is transformation and not just proper doctrine or proper ideas is in itself transforming.
That whole idea of going to the mall is a liturgy, materialism, consumption is a liturgy. Fascinating. And I've read a little bit in Jonathan Grant's book, Divine Sex, about that.
Yep.
It is compelling. And we don't understand just how much control that has over us as adults and especially over our kids. That's defining life for them. So what he's giving us here is a way to redefine. Hey, all right, I see a stack of books. You've got some more books there. In about 3 minutes,
okay,
give us rapid fire.
All right, folks, here we go. Renovate by Leonce Crump. This is kind of something Jamie Smith likes, this sense of place. I don't know many African-American urban pastors who have a passion for the Lordship of Christ and are reading Wendell Berry about a sense of place and a sense of good eating and nutrition. He's an inner city pastor, and the subtitle is Changing Who You Are by Loving Where You Are. So this is loving your sense of place, almost like that other book I like so much this season called Staying is the New Going, a NAV Press book. It's about loving your place. We have to talk about the church, a high view of church, even in youth ministry. And I think my favorite local book or recent book on the church is called Disappearing Church, From Cultural Relevance to Gospel Resilience by Mark Sayers. He's an Australian cultural critic. He wrote The Trouble with Paris. Postmodern, interesting critic of culture. You would like him a lot. Well, Mark Sayers, read anything he does. He has a book on leadership. But this book on the church is just a must read for any of us that are trying to get at why the church is important in our time. Of course, Good Faith by Kinnaman and Gabe Lyon. You guys know them.
Yep.
That's being a Christian in society when society thinks you're either irrelevant or extreme. They do the polls. Kinnaman has done the Barna Group research of how many people think that even what we would consider moderate Christian beliefs are considered extreme. So how do you live in good faith in the culture when they think we're nuts and they think we're extreme? So that's a very wise book about
navigating.
And
I haven't read it, but I've looked through it. Yep. I have it. I've looked through it, and I think this is one that youth workers and parents could benefit from personally, but also actually uses fodder for discussion and teaching.
Absolutely
students,
use fodder for discussion. Yep. Yeah. And sexuality themes,
being
honest about all that stuff. My favorite book on this idea of vocation and work these days that's good for young people, vibrant, edgy, easy to read, not dry, is called Garden City by John Mark Comer. The subtitle is Work, Rest, and the Art of Being Human. We're seeing lots of books about that these days. Vocation, calling, living with not just a worldview, but engaging the world, because the biblical drama teaches us that God cares about it all. One such book, just for instance, is called The Story of Everything, How You, Your Pets, and the Swiss Alps Fit Into God's Plan for the World by Jared Wilson. Isn't that a great title? We're seeing more books you can use with kids to help them get this broad vision that God cares about it all and is restoring his creation with this drama. A book that says how to disciple young people to become leaders, to rise to the occasion to be leaders with that big drama in mind is called Storied Leadership, Living and Leading from a Christian Narrative by Brian Jensen and Keith Martell from your college out there in Geneva.
Yeah.
These are Geneva guys. Steve Garber says, a seamless story-formed vision of the good life and therefore what good leaders look like. But the good life has to be defined in terms of this broad story of God redeeming all things. So it starts there, then it gets at how you teach leadership development. As we engage the culture around us, Walt, I know this is something you do well. I would really recommend a book called The Wilderness of Mirrors, Trusting Again in a Cynical World. It's by Mark Maynell. He's British. And Mark has done the best book I've yet seen on the role of cynicism in our culture and how to trust when you're cynical and jaded.
Mm.
It's one of the things Steve Garber gets at sometimes in Visions of Vocation, how not to be jaded or cynical and keep on keeping on. But this book analyzes this wilderness, he calls it, of mirrors, where we just don't trust anything anymore. Why is that? Talk about the trends of our culture. Talk about cynicism weaving its way into the institutions, even in this political cycle. This is a profound and serious book, and I really would recommend people dig into it. Do we have time to tell you about two more?
Yeah, go ahead. Real quick.
Andy Crouch, one of our heroes, wrote Culture Making, wrote the best book on power I know of called Playing God. The sequel to that just came out. It is called Strong and Weak, Embracing a Life of Love, Risk, and True Flourishing. He says we need both strength, but also weakness. We need to be able to take risks and be vulnerable, not just live in our mom's basement forever. We have to get out there and do something, but that doesn't mean exercising power poorly. So how can we have strength and weakness together and take risk and flourish? It's a great, great little book.
I like what
you
said there.
This
would be a good one for emerging adulthood, extended adolescence.
I'm glad you got that little hint in there.
Yeah, I got that.
Hey, you know, I know you care, Walt, as many of us older guys do, about the future of the evangelical conversation. What evangelicals stand for nowadays, even with the stuff we're hearing about evangelicals in the news these days politically. There is a book that two friends of mine wrote that just came out. Ron Sider, one of my mentors, an impeccable evangelical, and Ben Lowe, a young Wheaton grad that's young and working on creation care stuff, college age. The two of them wrote a book, and the first half is Ron Sider saying, here's the stuff that evangelicals have stood for the last 50 years. And at the end of each chapter, several different things, classic evangelical doctrine, Ben, a young evangelical, responds and says, this is how our generation is seeing it. And they kind of argue back and forth with Ben responding to Ron. The other half of the book is Ben saying, I'm a young evangelical, rising new leader. Here's how we're seeing things. And then Ron, the old guy, retired, responds. So it's a little bit of give and take. They're pretty much on the same page, but you have this good intergenerational conversation on critical issues facing the church. It seems to me that then the discussion questions around that could be incredibly helpful for churches as younger and older talk together about flourishing in the body of Christ and staying true to the good news of the gospel.
This is good. This is good. And here's
great.
What I love about it. You know, Jason, most of these books you and I haven't heard about, and most people haven't heard about, and that's the beauty of what Byron does is he gives us, he connects the dots between our needs and good writing, good books that we need to read. This is good. Hey, Byron,
really
go ahead, and we'll close out with this. We've developed an arrangement with you. We want to support Hearts and Minds and send people there for books like this, and we just believe so much in what you're doing. We will put all these books, we'll post them all on the site, the podcast. People can see the list below where they can stream or download the podcast. And if people come to your store, we have a code, CPYU.
If people say that they came to Hearts and Minds via CPYU, we'll give you 20% off on all these books. On any books they order, if we can. Now, every now and then, people order books, some wacky thing from some other country, you never know, and we end up losing money on it. We can get all kind of books. If it's in print, we can get it. But the 20% off deal is, you know, 90% of the books, CPYU would suggest the stuff you're working on, the stuff we're announcing here, certainly. We'll give you 20% off on all of them.
Good, good. And so just go look at the page for the podcast. Down beneath, we'll have all this listed, more information on Byron and Hearts and Minds. And we are grateful that you came to be with us. Jason, anything you want to say as we finish out?
He shakes his head.
He
no.
left.
Thanks,
Jason. You're going to have to edit this out. You're going to have to edit this
it's
out.
It's great to talk to you guys. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Byron, give us the website one more time.
It's www.heartsandmindsbooks.com. One long word, all spelled out, heartsandmindsbooks.com. We're in Dallastown, Pennsylvania. We have a real store. We have a website presence, and our website order form is secure, so we can take credit card orders and send the books anywhere. It's fun to do.
Yeah, and if you're ever in the area, if you're listening, you're ever in the area, we've sent people down there. They love the store. I love to go in and just browse. Take the day. I mean, it's just amazing what's in there. So thanks, Byron. Thanks, Jason, again for being with us. And we will talk to you next time on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.